From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. North Carolina's U.S. House District 7 stretches from the southeastern coast of North Carolina, encompassing Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties, west to the more rural Columbus, Sampson, Wayne, and Duplin counties. The district also includes portions of Johnston and Bladen County. David Rouser, a Republican historically from Johnston County who recently moved to New Hanover, has represented the district for two terms and is seeking his third. He faces two challengers this year, Democratic candidate Kyle Horton and Constitution Party candidate David Fallon, whom we will meet first today, as the candidates are arranged alphabetically. This is the first election year in North Carolina that the Constitution Party has had a spot on the ballot. David Fallon says he's lived in eastern North Carolina for more than 25 years. He's owned a small business, a construction company, since 1996. He's also served as a high school basketball referee for 26 years and a college basketball referee for 16. This is his second run at elected office, and he joins us now. David Fallon, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Today's interviews are pre-recorded, which means we are not taking live calls or emails. David Fallon, let's begin with the party that you've chosen to affiliate with. How would you describe where the Constitution Party falls on the political spectrum?
They have been trying for about 10 years working in to get into, onto the ballot, and I believe North Carolina is the 15th state to adopt it. They're trying to go back to what the conservative values and the Constitution represented from the beginning.
When I look at the principles on the state party's website and I see things like sanctity of life, I think conservative Republican leaning, anti-abortion, for instance, Second Amendment rights, strong supporters. Is that accurate? Is
correct. Those are a lot of the key core values. You know, the freedom of religion, and even though, not sure how to put that, but yes, the, you know, gun control, we're not in for gun control. We're firm believers in the Second Amendment and what it stands for, you know, protecting yourselves, and it's originally set up to protect us from the government, not so much our neighbors, but hopefully all the neighbors stand together and, you know, we wouldn't have a lot of these issues with guns that we do. But
And in light of that, there is a base, with a conservative base within the Republican Party, that also would align with those values. Why is the Republican Party not a place for Constitution Party people like you?
Well, they were. I've been a Republican all my life. Coming up and this new party, it just made sense to change to it. It represented all the values that, you know, we stand for. And I believe the other parties originally started out with a lot of those similar values. The Republican core values is, you know, there's three or four pages of them, and they represented a lot of the same issues. The difference is the little bit of the corruption that's gone on between, and the me mentality for the parties and not what's right for the people.
Can you give us an example of that? Something that's happened recently that you consider corruption and not really representing constituents?
Without getting into specifics, there's obviously, you see so much of it, you know, with the liberals, with their agendas and just pushing things that we're thinking, okay, why are these people not in jail? A lot of the media, which you probably see and hear more in your position, I'd like to see it get back to where reporters have to either quote sources, you know, speak the truth, speak what's happening, and don't turn it around for an agenda or to make somebody else look bad, like they were just trying to do with the Kavanaugh situation. Yeah, that's a big one there. So,
well, let's take the Kavanaugh situation. A lot of people, I mean, wherever people fall on that issue and how that process unfolded, most people seem to agree that it didn't go very well.
True.
That there were a lot of things that went wrong in that process. And it also emphasized the polarization of this country and the fact that people are more divided than ever and are self-sorting more than ever. Do you think that we lose anything by continuing to self-sort and isolate ourselves from people who think differently than we do?
A lot of times, yes, depending on what it is. The country itself with their agendas are different and like to divide. However, as you've seen before, if something comes against this country from an outside source, we band together very well. We have storms, we band together. You know, politics, you know, basically the meaning of it is to come to common cause for indifferences, which people are going to have. So trying to get enough decisions to make the common core what's right for the country and for the people and not for an individual or a specific group.
One of your prime issues, David Fallon, is cracking down on illegal immigration. The Trump administration recently removed temporary protected status from immigrants coming from Haiti, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Sudan. It was 1990 that President H.W. Bush signed the Immigration Act into law, which allows immigrants from countries affected by things like armed conflict or environmental disaster or other extraordinary conditions to live and work in the U.S. until it's safe for them to return home. All four of those countries that just lost their temporary protected status would fall under that rubric. Do you think the United States has any moral responsibility to protect people who are seeking shelter from those things?
Yes and no. I mean, ones that are obviously people like to improve their status or their lifestyle and want to come over. However, there are borders for a reason, and we can't just allow the whole country just to shift in and, you know, take over that much. So legally, I'm all for, you know, people coming in and working and paying taxes along with the rest of us. But given special benefits to the ones coming in that exceed benefits of current U.S. citizens.
What's an example of an immigrant who has a benefit that a U.S. citizen doesn't have?
They give them a lot more to get started, I guess, with health care and just other income, you know, and a lot of these will start working and don't pay as much taxes as they ought to. And in some cases, most of them are legit and hard workers, and I work with a lot of them, and they're good people. So I don't like to see anything bad go to any of them. But there's got to be a gray area that we can do it correctly and without just allowing everybody to come in and, you know, them just bailing on where they're at or their family. But I know one guy that used to be here, and I forget whether it was Mexico or one of those countries that direction, but he was working here and putting his sister through medical school in Mexico at the time. But he was legit with everything, and it was great. But, yeah, the ones that come in and, you know, just all pile up together and don't pay taxes or, you know, other than our local economy, obviously they're paying back into that. But, yeah, if it's done legally, I have no problem with any of it.
And you would have a unique perspective on this because you've had your own construction company since 1996, is it? And we know that in North Carolina, the construction business often uses people who are immigrants, who are not born in the United States. Part of the struggle there is an economic one.
Yep.
We know that if you force a situation where all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, construction costs go up. How do you deal with that as a business owner?
I do a lot of it myself. It's hard to find people that even want to work. There is a labor shortage. Special trades and things there that need to be developed more. So I know there are some trade schools going up for our local areas here that will help. But again, it's trying to find the people that even want to work or want to learn and do and get out from behind a computer or, you know, their phone long enough to do something. I've had a few come out, and when they found out how many hours I worked or what was involved, they didn't last but a couple of days. So, you know, and then dealing with any other immigrants that have come in, you know, you have a language barrier and some transportation issues, and there's, you know, finding out are they legal or not. And so, yeah, there's a lot to deal with. I've managed to keep mine pretty small and keep it to one or two employees and myself. But again, finding somebody you can trust and depend on and not have to babysit the whole time, it's a challenge.
One of the key issues for people in the 7th Congressional District, which you would know about as a resident of Pender County, is clean drinking water. It was relatively recently that members of the public learned multiple chemical compounds that are currently unregulated and unable to be filtered out of the water supply with the current technology are in the drinking water supply for several hundred thousand people. We know these compounds are likely dangerous to human health, and the EPA is working now on setting a standard for the ones that fall into the category of PFAS. In light of this, is there a place for regulation in a healthy government? I know one of your key issues is deregulation, but is this an exception, or would you say that market forces could also somehow create a healthy drinking water supply? What would you do with this issue if you didn't have to get consensus?
I'm not sure where it would fall in with the federal versus local government handling all this in the private sector for private drinking water suppliers. Obviously, we need to protect our resources. You know, so if companies are dumping, and, you know, that needs to be regulated somehow or controlled or cleaned before, you know, it goes somewhere. Obviously, anything you have going out has to be disposed of, or, you know, things have to be handled. But, yeah, we got to figure out how to keep it clean, keep the water clean. Obviously, I mean, you can't live without it. And after the storm, whatever was in the river, the fish were trying to swim out of the water instead of staying in. So, and we don't live too far off, and we're on a well. So trying to, you know, what God gave the ground the reason to filter, our natural filter system, you know, I'm really dependent on that right now. So, yeah, some of that needs to be protected.
So if you became the congressman from North Carolina's 7th District, would you support further EPA regulation of things like chemical compounds in the water supply?
I'd have to look into it, but yeah, to get educated on it to see what we could do and not do without, you know, hurting the environment or hurting the companies involved as well. So, you know, to keep all involved. Obviously, you want to keep costs down, but not hide money to not be able to keep everybody safe.
What do you think the funding responsibility of the federal government is when it comes to North Carolina's shoreline preservation or beach renourishment? Do you think that the federal government should continue to fund the preservation of North Carolina beaches?
Definitely help. I think the local towns and areas are responsible first, and if they need help, then, you know, we go to the next level to get assistance. But the beaches are important. I mean, that's another resource, you know, plus with the economy and tourism. So it's important to keep those up and, you know, clean and running and nourished and, you know, keep it all looking nice. So, yes.
The United Nations recently released a climate change report that sounds the alarm and emphasizes the importance of cutting emissions by 45% by 2030 in order to keep the warming of this planet within 1.5 degrees Celsius. Do you share this concern? Why or why not?
I don't know a lot of the details from their end of it yet. I know our ecosystem, our planet, whatever, has cycles. So whether we're in one of those cycles, you know, I'm not sure. obviously the ultimate creator has all this in place for a reason. So obviously we're here to manage and protect it, I guess you should say, take care of it. But yeah, I don't know how much of the emissions and things that are actually affecting.
So you're a little skeptical of the idea that human activity is causing climate change. That's what you're saying.
Some of it could. I don't think overall it's not the main reason for it all. So it's not going to stop it if it is. But I think we're in a cycle, and it's probably, I couldn't say how many years, but you know, it will come back around.
A high priority on the Republican agenda is to do away with Obamacare, otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act. Opponents of that move are concerned that people with pre-existing conditions will not be able to get health insurance. Do you have an answer for that?
Obviously, I don't care for pre-existing conditions. Obviously, with my situation, since I've had the two heart attacks myself, but I don't think government should be regulating people's health care and manage health insurance.
So
I think that should stay.
You would support repealing Obamacare?
Yes.
And that is this segment of the Coastline Candidate Interviews. David Fallon, thank you so much for sharing your views with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still ahead, Congressman David Rauser and Democratic candidate Dr. Kyle Horton, whom we'll meet next. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You are listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're meeting the three candidates seeking to represent North Carolina's 7th Congressional District. Republican Congressman David Rauser has held the seat for two terms and is seeking his third. He faces challenges from a Constitution Party candidate, whom we met in the first segment, and Democratic nominee Dr. Kyle Horton, who beat out Grayson Parker in the primary. Dr. Kyle Horton is an internal medicine doctor with a business degree. She's worked in the emergency department at Duke University before medical school. She's also provided veteran-specific health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs. After her residency, she stayed to train medical residents at the VA, and she cared for veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom in a post-deployment clinic. She lives in Curie Beach, and she joins us now. Kyle Horton, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
And this is a pre-recorded interview, just a reminder for our listeners. One of the key issues, as you know, for people in the 7th Congressional District in North Carolina is clean drinking water. The public learned relatively recently that multiple chemical compounds that are currently unregulated and probably dangerous to human health are in the drinking water supply. The EPA has yet to issue some of these regulatory guidelines for these chemical compounds. We hear it's coming. If you were elected to this seat, how would you handle the next several steps?
So what I think needs to happen, Rachel, is that, you know, as your congresswoman, is I need to bring my expertise as a physician and someone who's committed to public health to the table to inform our policy. And so we're concerned with Gen X, and then also many folks may not realize that the ugly cousin of Gen X is actually in firefighting foam around Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in particular. So this class of compounds that we believe may cause cancer, it may be associated with thyroid, like gland dysfunction, needs to be addressed. But as you mentioned, with the EPA, my opponent has been someone who's taken money from the likes of the DuPont Good Government Fund before. And I do realize DuPont and good government do not belong together. But there's been a tide of defunding and dismantling the EPA by extremists. And so what I think needs to happen is, one, we need to strengthen and fund the EPA appropriately. And then we need to look to innovation in public health. So the Center for Disease Control has what's called an environmental public health tracking network. And what that does is it enables like county public health departments that already track cancer rates and things like that to provide that data directly to the CDC. And then we could look at trends to really figure out what we could expect so doctors know how to test and address these emerging contaminants like Gen X. And we figure out what these safe threshold levels are or how to protect our families.
There are studies underway, but we do hear from some folks that when the news broke that Gen X was in the water and had been dumped into the water, its predecessor also, I think, C8, for about 30 years.
Yes.
People looked for health anomalies and didn't find any in this region. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I think there's some complacency there because we have seen some variation in rates of thyroid disease. There have been some variations and concerns about GI-related illnesses in particular. Brain cancers are something that people had looked at before, that there seemed to be some anomalous trends in this part of North Carolina. But again, this is where with this environmental public health tracking network, if you can really look regionally and say in the western part of the state where they don't have Gen X or C8 derivatives, that we see very significant differences in disease patterns, then we would really know for sure, because that can be correlated with animal models then. And really, once we know that it's confirmed in animal studies and then in humans, that's pretty definitive.
We hear that repealing the Affordable Care Act is a primary objective of the Republican Party. And one of the stated reasons is that people shouldn't be forced to buy health care that they either don't want or can't afford. And we heard anecdotally from people after Obamacare went into effect that some folks were weighing the financial difference between the penalty for not having health insurance and the actual cost of health insurance. Where do you think this needs to go?
Yeah, so I'm deeply concerned about this mantra of, you know, after 7 years of repeal and replace, what we learned is that the Republican leadership in Congress didn't really have a plan to replace. It was repeal and take away, you know, millions of Americans' health care and do away with protections for those with pre-existing conditions. Well, needless to say, as a doctor, I'm deeply committed to health care. And I believe that health care should be a right in this country and not just a privilege for the wealthiest few. But what has happened is that the biggest pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and their lobbyists have wielded so much power that we're not moving our healthcare system forward in the way that it is. So more important than the mandate is, I think, trying to cover more Americans and to ensure that they can afford the coverage that they want. So what we are talking about with our campaign is steps towards getting towards, you know, expanded Medicare that would cover folks. And how we would get there is lower the Medicare eligibility age to age 50. Then we can negotiate drug prices across those millions of Americans. And we can figure out cost containment measures to get some price accountability and figure out how to draw more insurance companies in to enhance competition. And we could expand Medicaid federally, regionally in the South, where states wrongly chose to put partisan politics over people's lives and did not expand Medicaid, which is something that Congressman Rauser was opposed to Medicaid expansion in the state Senate. And if we federally expanded Medicaid and set up a regional marketplace and then start incrementally covering more folks with Medicare, they'd have more choices. We'd have more competition, more control on bringing down healthcare costs and reining in those big pharmaceutical and insurance companies.
So you're saying that federal expansion would then be funded by the federal government and would sort of bypass the state's rulings on that?
Absolutely. So where, you know, states like North Carolina, as you know, with Medicaid expansion, we were supposed to get our federal taxpayer dollars back here in North Carolina to cover more North Carolinians, but people chose out of spite to play partisan politics and not expand Medicaid. And that has devastating effects as we're dealing with the opiate crisis in particular. A lot of people don't realize that roughly a quarter of mental health care and a fifth of substance abuse care is covered by Medicaid. But my opponent has opposed Medicaid expansion and is now trying to push an extremist dialogue of work requirements, Well, people should realize that the vast majority of Medicaid recipients are working individuals. They're just working poor, and they're not being paid a living wage.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Dr. Kyle Horton, the Democratic challenger, seeking to represent North Carolina's 7th Congressional District. Incumbent Congressman David Rauser is seeking his third term. Constitution Party candidate David Fallon is challenging Rauser's seat as well. Today's interviews are pre-recorded. It's very easy, as the Republicans have learned, to trumpet the failings of the other side when you're not in a position to get your own agenda on the docket. What do you think the Republicans have done right in Washington?
So it's a tough one recently, because I feel like things have gone way more extreme than what the Republican Party used to represent. And I do think there are some strengths in the way that Republicans have traditionally valued national security and making sure that they keep us safe. And I think that's critically important. But there's a line as well between keeping us safe and respecting our national security and standing in the world, and then, you know, warmongering or just funding defense contractors to the hilt and basically privatizing war. So while I think that they've done a good job of funding defense in the past, I feel like we've now gone to the other extreme. And I think this is why it's so important for leaders like me to run, who are practical, who've worked across the aisle, and who will not embrace this tide of extremism. But people should know that Congressman Rauser is ranked 404th out of 465 members in the House for unwillingness to work bipartisan and work across the aisle, that actually puts him as more extreme than Tea Party head Mark Meadows of the Freedom Caucus.
We actually heard from Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona on 60 Minutes that there's no value in reaching across the aisle. He said there is no currency for that anymore. There's no incentive. So even if you were elected and you went to Washington and you were willing to do that, how are you going to change the tide? How are you going to change the dynamic of this very serious polarization?
Yeah, I think the key is to make politics personal, and that's really what we're trying to do with our campaign. So I think what Senator Flake was getting to is that there's so much money in politics, there's so much cronyism and corruption, that people feel like they have to pay their dues to the party that they're in instead of feeling accountable to their districts and the people. But I'm a different kind of leader. That's why we've done so many town halls to actually get out in the communities. In the wake of Florence, we went into the hardest hit communities. I didn't just go to emergency management centers and talk to, you know, career politicians. I got into the communities. And so then what I will bring to the table, and why I do think there's value in working across the aisle, is that in the way that I worked with Senator Tillis, who took Senator Burr's place on the Veterans Committee, these were really personal issues. We have a lot of veterans. Here we're sandwiched between Bragg and Lejeune. Seymour Johnson's in the district. They were willing to work with me on solutions, and Senator Tillis co-sponsored a bill with Senator Amy Klobuchar to help veterans exposed to burn pits because it was personal to the people that they represent. But I was able to paint that picture because I knew the stories of veterans and bothered to listen to them and get out in the communities and to meet people where they are.
Beach nourishment, shoreline stabilization, that's a serious concern for coastal stakeholders in the 7th District. And, of course, the incumbent, Congressman David Rauser, has done a good job of keeping federal funds flowing to this area. If you were elected, should constituents worry that this influence he has in Washington that gets federal funds for the beaches, would that go away?
No, it most definitely wouldn't. So I live in a beach community of Curry Beach, and I do give him kudos. He has done a good job of securing beach renourishment funds, and I believe we should continue exactly in the way he has of doing matching funds local to state. It's been working. I would, you know, be able to accomplish the same things that he has. But what I want people to know is that it's easier to plan long-term for beach renourishment when you acknowledge things like the threat of climate change. My opponent has denied the scientific reality of climate change. And actually, when he was in the state Senate, he introduced a bill banning consideration of accelerated sea level rise. That bill actually made us a national laughingstock. Stephen Colbert called it E equals MC scared. And so if we acknowledge the scientific reality of climate change and how that might threaten our beach communities over the long term, we're going to be able to find much more effective long-term funding strategies and solutions. So they should know I'll be practical and solution-minded.
One of the concerns for people who aren't considering sea level rise when they look at development along the coast is that all of this currently buildable land will suddenly become unbuildable. That is a serious loss of revenue. How do you address that? I mean, it's very easy to say climate change is happening. We need to plan for it and become more resilient and take some of these beachfront areas off the table. But then who loses?
Yeah, so that's really short-term thinking, though, Rachel, and that's my concern is that, you know, it's short-term revenue that they're looking at that we wouldn't be able to develop those properties in the short run. But what we know is with Florence in the wake of Matthew, that we had two horrendous hurricanes that are essentially they're becoming superstorms being fueled by global warming. So then it is costing us billions, and now it's going to probably be trillions after all of these hurricanes to recover in these areas that no one should have built in the first place because they're far too vulnerable. And so I'm thinking long-term instead of just short-term revenue gains. And people should know that this is a matter of public health. It's a matter of fiscal responsibility to ensure that properties that we build can survive over the long-term and withstand storms.
One of the byproducts of Hurricane Florence was the breaching of Duke Energy coal ash into the Cape Fear River, also of some Hog Lagoon waste. And people who are supporters of hog farmers, which that's a lot of people in the state, it's a key component of North Carolina's agricultural economy, say a tiny percentage of hog lagoons breached, a tiny percentage, most didn't. Where do you stand on that? And considering these superstorms, does anything need to change?
It does need to change, but they're right. It was a small percentage overall, and pork is a critical industry in the state, and I am adamantly pro-farmer, but it's important to note that our agriculture policy at the federal level has become about multinational corporations, in many cases being run out of China and in other countries that don't respect our environmental policies and our health and well-being here. And so while my family, my great-grandparents had a small tobacco farm in eastern Kentucky. I respect the role agriculture is because it's a part of who we are in eastern North Carolina. I will fight for farmers every day on the Hill, but all of the risk has been put on our small and family farmers. And so what needs to change is we protect small and family farmers.
And that's our time. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Dr. Kyle Horton, thanks for sharing your views with us.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
When we come back from this break, we'll meet Republican incumbent David Rauser. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You are listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're meeting the candidates for North Carolina's 7th Congressional District, which encompasses the coastal counties, Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender, spreads west to the more rural Columbus, Sampson, Wayne, and Duplin counties. The district also includes portions of Johnston and Bladen County. David Rauser, a Republican historically from Johnston County who recently moved his residence to New Hanover County, has represented the district for two full terms and is seeking his third. Before serving in the U.S. House, David Rauser spent two terms as a North Carolina state senator representing District 12. He joins us now. David Rauser, welcome to Coastline.
Oh, great to be with you.
Great to have you here. And just a reminder for our listeners, this interview is pre-recorded. More than 30 inches of rain from Hurricane Florence fell in some parts of North Carolina. State residents saw damage from storm surge, catastrophic flooding. They suffered through extended power outages. Authorities have confirmed at least 40 storm-related deaths. The damage is estimated to reach billions of dollars, including at least $1.1 billion just in crop and livestock losses. More than a billion has been appropriated for North Carolina recovery efforts. Is that going to be enough? And what's on the horizon? Will the state see additional help?
The state absolutely will see additional help. And let me preface all this by saying I have nine counties that you listed in the intro, seven whole, two partial. All nine of them were declared federal disaster areas. And eight of those nine were basically underwater. Many of those eight in some places are still underwater. When you have a flood of this magnitude and of this severity, it portends a very long recovery period. That's point number one. Patience is going to be really important. All my life I've heard that patience is a virtue. It really is. The federal government, its role is to make sure that the state and the local entities have the resources that they need. There's been tremendous coordination between the federal government, the state government, and the local entities, all of them working hand in glove, working very, very well together to see through this response effort and now in the beginnings of the long-term recovery effort. We've had probably almost half the cabinet come to Eastern North Carolina, in addition to the president. In recent weeks. In fact, just the other day, we had Secretary Acosta, Secretary of Labor, Secretary Ben Carson, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, both here in Wilmington, and in fact, traveling around some of the other counties as well. Secretary Sonny Perdue has been here. This is a very large and strong agriculture district, as many of your listeners probably know. Once you get about 30 miles inland, it's a major mecca of agriculture. Everything from strawberries to blueberries to hogs, turkeys, and chickens. One of the most dominant agriculture districts in the country, quite frankly. And as you mentioned, all have taken huge losses. In fact, agriculture in this district completely, totally wiped out. So Congress came forward about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, and put forward an appropriations measure that was attached to the FAA reauthorization bill. That included $1.14 billion for North Carolina and about half a billion for South Carolina. That money goes through the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Program. The reason why we allocate money through that program, it is by far the most flexible program that we can funnel money to so that the state can use that money based on the specific needs that they find on the ground. A lot of that money is intended for housing. It's intended for infrastructure repair and other things of that sort. We will come back after the election. Congress returns November the 13th, and we will be working on a comprehensive supplemental disaster package as part of another appropriations measure that will probably be passed right before we come home for Christmas. It's going to be a lot of work to figure out exactly all the damages that are throughout the district. Now, that takes a while to compile.
We've heard some people estimate that, you know, $1.1 billion, that's just a third.
That's just agriculture.
Yeah.
That's not structures and everything else. It's going to be substantial. So what we're doing now is we are working to put together all the needs that are presented to us by all the local entities, whether it's related to schools, whether it's related to agriculture, whether it's related to housing, et cetera, infrastructure. All those things we're putting together, and it won't be, just be a supplemental package later in December. We'll come back next year with other additional measures to help address and expedite this long-term recovery effort.
And the recent storms have also raised again the issue of shoreline stabilization, beach renourishment. That's something that is always a question when we're talking about federal funding.
Well, and that's front and center in this district, and it's an issue that I raised with the president at the roundtable several weeks ago when he was there at Cherry Point and was visiting Newbern and those surrounding areas. Infrastructure includes our beach nourishment, our dredging of our inlets and our waterways, and also I think it's really important that we have a renewed focus on cleaning out these rivers, streams, creeks, these ditches. All of them are so clogged from just years and years of wear and tear, so to speak, plus Hurricane Matthew, where it hit.
Are you talking about some kind of dredging effort for those smaller waterways?
Well, you could consider that dredging, yes. I just call it, they have a program in the federal government called Snag and Drag, basically where you snag on to all those limbs and tree trunks and everything else that's clogging up the waterways. You've got beaver dams of all sorts. Water has to have somewhere to go. And, of course, if you're going to have 30-plus inches of rain, you're going to have flooding. There's no question about that. It's just an intense and significant amount of rain. But you need to have some place for that water to go. And when your ditches are all clogged up, your rivers, your streams, creeks, et cetera, that flow into those bigger rivers, all that makes a big difference in terms of alleviating future flooding.
And as a result of all of that flooding, we've seen breaches of hog lagoons. We've seen a breach of coal ash into the Cape Fear River, which is a drinking water supply source. There have been new environmental concerns around the impacts from these severe storms. And, of course, in the past when we've seen storms, we've also seen hog lagoons breach. What does that tell us about how we're managing hog waste?
Well, I think it's important to understand that in eastern and southeastern North Carolina, you have roughly 3,400 hog lagoons, hog farms. And of those, only 20 had any issue whatsoever, and I think maybe four or five had some type of breach. So from a statistical standpoint, that is a remarkable record. On the other hand, and this is not a criticism whatsoever, because folks have to do what folks need to do, these municipalities in particular, when you have a flood of this magnitude, and by the way, this was a 1,000-year flood, and you have a significant amount of sewage that is dumped into the rivers just naturally. And these municipalities, they have a permit that enables them to do that because, quite frankly, there's no other choice for them. So the reason why I point that out, there's always a lot of focus about hog farms and lagoons and breaches. But if you fly over eastern North Carolina, as I did right after the storm, there's an interesting phenomenon that you will see. Many of those farms, can't say all of them, but many of those farms, when you look down, you will see the flooding around the, not to the hog houses and not to the lagoons, because they put those on higher elevation. What flooded on many of those farms were the farmers' homes and their barns and tractors and other things that are around it. So they specifically put those farms at higher elevation. A lot of people don't realize that. And that's part of the reason they had such a remarkable record during this storm. Only five had any kind of breach whatsoever out of 3,400.
One of the key issues for the people in the 7th Congressional District in North Carolina is clean drinking water. The public learned relatively recently that multiple chemical compounds that are currently unregulated and with current technology unable to be filtered out are in the drinking water supply for several hundred thousand people. These compounds are dangerous to human health. The EPA is working now on setting a standard for PFAS. In light of this revelation, is there a place for greater regulation in this part, in a healthy government? If you were in charge of the drinking water supply for this region, how would you handle dealing with the industries who emit these chemical compounds?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand there's thousands of unregulated contaminants, as they call it. Gen X fits under that category. I'd never heard anything about Gen X until the news reports this past summer. And, of course, one thing that popped out to me was that it had been discharged in the river since the early 1980s, 30-some years. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of Health and Human Services, the governor, and others came down. We had a meeting of all the local officials. I was in attendance for this one particular meeting where we raised the question, what's the health data show? If this has been in the water for 30-plus years, which was news to all of us, Mayor Sappho, Woody White, all of us around the table were like, is that what they just said? It's been in the water for 30 years. If that's the case, what does the health data show? Is there any abnormality? Is there anything that protrudes its head in the health data that gives some indication of the severity of this issue? And I remember very specifically Mandy Cohen saying they had looked at all that and there were no abnormalities that they could find whatsoever. Now, at that point in time, I met with Kim Moores. They came and visited with me in my office at my request.
And you took a $1,000 contribution, campaign contribution from DuPont representatives, the parent company of Kim Moores.
And Kim Moores is a spinoff of DuPont. But if you look at my campaign contributions, I receive a tremendous amount from a number of different folks.
Why would you take a campaign contribution from DuPont in light of what happened with GenX?
Well, number one, at the time that was made, I didn't know anything about GenX. They had pledged to a fundraiser of mine early in that quarter. And their money came in. The way a lot of PACs do it is they give out all their checks to the members at the same time, at the very end of the quarter. So the timeline there, for one thing, is not accurate that I received the money after learning of GenX. But let me say this. Kim Moores is a complete, total, separate entity from DuPont. Now, what is important?
But DuPont is responsible for dumping a lot of chemical compounds into waterways in other parts of this country, and they've faced lawsuits over that, and there have been documented health effects from some of the compounds they've dumped. So I don't think you can characterize DuPont as having no hand in this.
Well, the fact of the matter is Kim Moores is a spinoff. DuPont, it does not have managerial responsibility over what Kim Moores does. And I think the really important point moving forward is that you have a whole class of what they call unregulated contaminants. And I think the EPA, and I said this publicly way back then, the EPA needs to come up with some standard for these unregulated contaminants. And they had pledged to me long ago, and they're working on this, of coming up with a standard, a health standard for GenX. I think that's important, and not just for GenX, but all these others that are in the water
as
well.
All of the compounds one classification.
Mm-hmm, that's correct. But there are many more unregulated contaminants as well. I never thought of the term unregulated contaminant or unidentified contaminant, whatever it is that they refer to it officially, until the GenX scenario came about. And the fact of the matter is they're working on developing a standard so that we know. And I asked them, I said, how confident are you going to be in the standard that you release? And they said, we're going to be very, very confident in it because we have the expertise and the personnel to be able to determine what's safe and what's not safe. It's going to take us a little bit of time to do it, but it's going to be sooner rather than later. And I anticipate, based on what they told me, that the EPA will have some standard that they set forth here in the next few months.
The Trump administration has started compensating U.S. farmers for damage that tariffs are doing to their business. But according to the Wall Street Journal, many farmers are saying those payments won't make up for lost sales to China and other foreign markets they were counting on to buy the huge amount of crops and meat being produced. North Carolina exports a little more than $32.5 billion of goods and services. What would you say to North Carolina farmers who are struggling now with that tariff load?
Well, the fact of the matter is we just renegotiated, the administration did, I think a very good deal with Mexico and Canada that's going to be beneficial to all of American agriculture. It did no harm whatsoever to the pork industry and pork exports there. That Mexico is a huge, huge market for pork. And it's a real feather in the administration's cap that they were able to basically improve upon the NAFTA agreement that was in place that had been so beneficial to agriculture in this country. With respect to China, which is where the main focus on tariffs lies, look, China is communist. A lot of people forget that. They lie, cheat, and steal every chance they get. They have stolen our intellectual property for years and years and years. And the president's purpose and focus with these tariffs as it relates to China is to use them as a leveraging point to bring them back to the table and renegotiate a better arrangement, a better trade arrangement, and force China to quit stealing our intellectual property. They are notorious for it, and they don't just steal ours, they steal everybody's.
I want to move to the art of compromise, because this is something that you and I talked about a couple years ago. Just a minute left, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona recently told 60 Minutes there's no value in reaching across the aisle, no currency for that anymore. Is that true? And if that's true, what do you think we lose?
You know, the coarseness of our politics today is what bothers me, very much so. And I think we need to get back and understand that the other side is not the enemy. They just have a different perspective, a different point of view. And we need to build those bridges and work together. But quite honestly, the bases of the two parties have gone to such an extreme, it makes it harder and harder to do that.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Congressman David Rauser, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
Thanks also to Kyle Horton and David Fallon. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. Remember, early voting is underway. Election Day is November 6th. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.